Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is a panel from the Veterans for Peace 2024 convention entitled Resisting Repression, Strategies of Solidarity in the New McCarthy Era. The convention was held online August 16th through the 18th, 2024. In the face of escalating efforts by the U.S. government to marginalize peace groups, journalists, activists, and other dissenting voices, this timely panel discussion examines strategies to navigate the current landscape of censorship, repression, and persecution. The panel of activists, Jody Evans of Code Pink, Jesse Neville of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, and Ali Wong of Columbia University, share their firsthand experiences and insights with being targets of these malign efforts. From media smears to financial targeting to malicious legal prosecution, these tactics aim to silence those who challenge the status quo and manufacture consent for a wide range of despotic global and domestic policies that harken back to the bad old days of the Red Scare. We'll start with Jody Evans, co-founder and a current board member of Code Pink. She has been a visionary advocate for peace for decades, as evident through the numerous documentary films she has produced and the books she has written. More recently, Jody Evans and Code Pink have been targeted by senior members of Congress for their resistance to U.S. policies of genocide and reckless brinkmanship.
So, peace and love. What a blessing to be invited to another Veterans for Peace conference. I love you, Peacemakers, so much. I've been arrested and jailed with many of you, I can see, and marched alongside you, and I'm so grateful for all the ways you use your life and voices for peace. Thank you. And thank you just for what your hearts are. I just have deepest respect. Coming to this, I was remembering 2005 when we started Camp Casey at the end of this conference and turned the country from pro-Iraq war to against. But, you know, let's just start with Cindy Sheehan, who paid a huge price. And, you know, watching the daily McCarthyism on her was profound. So I just, you know, want to bring that moment here. Sitting there watching her get attacked at the core of her heart every morning, she woke to a new attack. And let me say, they were heart ripping. She would cry for about a half an hour or so, pull herself together, and then head out to speak truth, regardless of the attacks. So for me, that is like the core of this. It's like, we will be attacked. The work we are doing will, you know, create attack, but it's the getting up, holding each other's hand and moving forward that I think is, you know, core to this work. We have to remember as peace activists, if we're being affected, we will be attacked. They want to destroy us. We are getting in the way of their need. At Code Pink, we have a t-shirt that says, the truth will set you free, but first it will piss them off. Gandhi taught us that nonviolent direct action exposes the violence we live inside. That violence will manifest in many forms, direct, like the brutal attacks and arrests on college campuses of peaceful pro-Palestinian activists, or slander, lies, lawfare, and long-term jail sentences. In the case of JFK, RFK, and MLK, it was death. Exposing or espousing truth can release horrific violence. So it doesn't mean we will be unharmed in our stance for peace. It is why others say you have courage when you stand up. They sense it has a price. They have witnessed the price. I understood this in high school in the 60s when I was reading about Emma Goldman, the anarchist who was jailed for 2 years because she was a peace activist. I was shocked that someone doing the right thing could be put in jail for it. Could be silenced so the war could continue. A woman with just a voice was so threatening to people with all those weapons. I hold that inside me for the rest of my life. But of course, we don't think about the risks when we're working for peace and justice. We are just moved by the love in our heart for humanity and the horror at the violence and cost of war. That is a human response. But the war machine must cut it out at all costs, really cut out humanity, because it's destroying life, right? In war, all costs are accepted, and unfortunately, we're witnessing that every day. as we see what's happening in Gaza. The most insane, immoral, psychopathic behavior is unleashed on innocent people, and most people are remaining silent, especially in the United States, which is the core of this violence. Yet there are those that are being jailed and having their lives destroyed because they stand for peace and humanity. So we call it New McCarthyism because of that disgraced Cold Warrior Senator Joe McCarthy, who was allowed insane and brutal behavior towards communists and others during the Red Scare in the 50s. Often we hear about it in relation to those mostly writers in Hollywood whose lives were destroyed, but other targets were Communist Party leaders, civil rights activists who associated with communists, State Department officials who questioned the wisdom of U.S. support for the losing side in the Chinese Civil War, union leaders, Puerto Rican independent activists, school teachers, and college professors. Some, especially the Communist Party leaders, were criminally prosecuted under the 1940 Smith Act. Others were left unemployed, unemployable, after being publicly accused of disloyalty. But rarely do we think about what happened to W.E. Du Bois, Claudia Jones, Paul Robeson, and the Rosenbergs, and the fear it sets up for others to limit their voice, their interests beyond the status quo, and their engagement. We've seen the engagement about justice for workers, for peace and equality shrink over decades. The activism has shrunk, and even the understanding of why we need to engage, organize, and never give up. That, however, is changing, and the curtains that have been thrown open for all to see the violence in its naked expression in Gaza is the moment we live in. We must love and work for peace and justice as much as they are fueled by their greed and power. I say they're on crack cocaine. We are driven by our hearts and truth. They will use anything and everything to get what they want, more power and more money. A year ago, the New York Times ran a hit piece on a group of us standing for peace who happened to get funding from the same person, my husband. Funny that they would think a husband supporting his wife would be strange, especially since our connection is rooted when he was in the audience at the People's Tribunal on Palestine in 2010, as we were speaking about our BDS campaign against Ahava. His appreciation of our activism started then, but you won't read about that. The piece ran after 2 months of work of 11 reporters, and it fell flat. Even with liberals, it fell flat. Some friends said, oh, you're right, the New York Times does the work for the State Department. That wasn't journalism. I had started the China's Not Our Enemy campaign to combat the propaganda I saw pouring from corporate media outlets who obediently push a dangerous authoritarian propaganda narrative on behalf of the most fanatical hawks in the U.S. national security state to make China our enemy and then go to war on them. Here, the propaganda created was to say you are either in support of Washington's hybrid war in China or you are secretly working for China, a good tool to silence all those who just plain like China, like Chinese Americans, since it's half of their DNA and is doing some amazing things like taking everyone out of poverty. They're not only silenced, but the violence against them has risen by multiples during this flood of propaganda. When I first received the questions from the New York Times, it was clear they were written by someone in the CIA. They were Hallmark questions, leading from a premise that was not true, full of accusations that were unfounded. My first response was to ignore them. The New York Times? Why do I care? I or anyone that I care about doesn't read it. And the report had just come out that almost 6 million people had died in the war on terror. The New York Times had pushed. They had pushed lies that drove those wars, including the stupid color-coded alerts that Bush used to frighten the American people into war, which is why we call ourselves Code Pink for Peace. I showed the questions to a friend and said, I haven't done anything wrong, so why answer? And she said, Jody, all your friends are in jail. Haven't done anything wrong either. So just days before the article ran, I sent a statement, not responding to the questions, just statements of facts that dispelled what they were accusing in their line of questions. How absurd to think a foreign government would fund a live wire like me. One never knows where I'm going to show up and expose the truth. You can't do that if you're living a lie. I am an unrepentant good troublemaker. But Julian Assange published The Truth About War, John Kiriakou exposed US using torture, and Daniel Hell exposed the violence of drones, and they were made to pay dearly. Well, the article ran on a Saturday. Those of us who were targeted went on the offensive on Sunday. We can't sue, as that's way too expensive, but we could use the moment to educate, inspire, activate, and make clear this isn't about us, but a tool to shut all of us up. So we launched McCarthyism is Back. Together we can stop it. We said we stand together against the rise of new McCarthyism that is targeting peace activists, critics of US foreign policy, and Chinese Americans. Despite increased intimidation, we will remain steadfast in our mission to foster peace and international solidarity, countering the narrative of militarism, hostility, and fear. At Code Pink, we're used to it. We're Putin apologists. We work for the Iranian government. We side with dictators. I mean, in the beginning, we were Saddam apologists. But this time, we were showered with love and support by those who saw it, as the McCarthyite racist, sexist article of lies, distortion, innuendo, and hate. Many offering love, and some saying that you must be doing something right, because they were taught to follow all those who were attacked by the New York Times. But that's not the experience of most who are attacked. The experience is lonely, guilt-ridden, embarrassing, and has costs. Real costs, personal, political, and psychological. The New York Times article was also followed by members of Congress and congressional committees calling for investigations. And now we have lawfare lawsuits, but this is targeting work on Palestine. Every member of Congress has been briefed with the article, not the absurdity of it, but the proof that Code Pink is funded by China. They would love to discredit our truth-telling in the halls of Congress, but it didn't work. The truth is still delivered daily and has great effect with interns, staff, and members. Many members know us and know our activism for peace to be potent and heart-driven and disregard. Others use it as the bludgeon it was meant to be. Like Nancy Pelosi, who hates that we disrupt her constant war narrative with our calls for peace. We actually look forward to them having a suit against us on FARA so we can bring up the FARA rules regarding AIPAC and bring up the fact that we're funded by 13,000 donors. There is what is obvious in the new McCarthyism and what is happening in the crevices and corners and beyond eyesight. It is used to silence, as I said, but it is also used to call out those who are not loyal soldiers to the empire. We can see the expelling of Cori Bush and Jamal Bowman, but not what that means about congressional staff. Even the voluntary calling by those who are stepping out of the Biden administration because of its position on Gaza, it has an effect on the entire fabric of those in power. It is now an alliance of far right and liberals. Both sides are cleaning up government from those who serve the people in peace. It is not only Trump the fascist trying to undermine government. People were purged who held responsibility to the needs of people and peace for decades, since Reagan and then Clinton. Project 2025 has been in practice for a very long time. McCarthyism did its part to cull those who were still left from Roosevelt, cleaning out those who still defend the rights of poor and working class and had an ideology or who were against the military-industrial complex. If you are effective in getting in the way of the plan for global hegemony, you are the enemy and the gloves are off. We think political is Democratic and Republican parties when it is and always has been the rich and the empire, the military-industrial complex against all those who get in their way. The people have demanded more in the past, have agitated for more, but too many people have been put to sleep with decades and decades of propaganda and a horrific education system that has been destroyed. We see it clearly in the encampments. Students who are clear and smart about what the truth is, have a moral compass and a commitment to all life, are being violently attacked by the universities and schools whose very mission are supposed to be what the students are fighting for? No, they've been dumbing down students to be cogs in the wheel for the empire for decades. And when you step outside what you're supposed to be doing, you are bludgeoned to shut up and everyone is witnessing. And then they tell the lies about it, what happened, and turn the truth upside down. So bringing us back to W.E.B. Du Bois, who said, "I am one who tells the truth and exposes evil and seeks with beauty for beauty to set the world white." We stand with Du Bois in this time of heightened hegemony, and that is a dangerous act. the cost of defiance tends to outweigh the cost of cooperation, including even during testimony, when one cannot appeal, when faced with an objectionable line of questioning, we can't summon witnesses, we can't cross-examine the other side, or sue members of Congress for libel in the hearings. Thankfully, the First Amendment prohibits the outright criminalization of political activism in this country, but censorship through more devious means is an old and enduring American tradition, one that can only be fought through collective courage, integrity, and defiance on a national scale. So stay off the propaganda machines. Stay in community as you are with Vets for Peace. You are strong and you create strength and power for peace. Teach. Many of you know this was core to our engagement in the 60s, and much need is arising for teaching now. Hearts and eyes are open. We need to be teachers and be allies. You are either on the side of the people or the empire. Don't let them divide us. It is another tool they use. Find your comrades, create with them, but don't judge others on what they're creating. It is going to take all of us in all forms. Let the forms exist. Let the flowers, you know, rise. Worry about yourselves, you know, gain your strength, your clarity, your commitment to truth and peace. Scratch and expose the empire and the rich who drive it, and cultivate your local peace economy. I learned very early in Code Pink, we can't end war till we end the war economy, the extractive, destructive, oppressive economy that is killing us, our communities, and the planet. We must all be cultivating a local peace economy so that we're not just being used in this war, but we are cultivating a future of a peace economy, the giving, sharing, caring, thriving relational economy without which none of us would be alive. The fight is on. The rich have control of everything. The war economy is running the show, but we have nothing to lose but our chains. Thank you.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is a panel from the Veterans for Peace 2024 convention entitled Resisting Repression, Strategies of Solidarity in the New McCarthy Era. We just heard Jody Evans, co-founder and a current board member of Code Pink. Next is Jesse Neville, who became active in the movement for reparations to African people in 2010 when he met Chairman Omali Yeshitela of the African People's Socialist Party. He has served as the national chair of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement since 2014, building white solidarity with African liberation and reparations under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party. Along with Chairman Omali Yeshitela and Penny Hess, Jesse is one of the Uhuru Three, who at the time of this conference faced charges of failing to register as Russian agents. The three were since acquitted on that charge, but convicted on the less serious charge of conspiracy.
Thank you to Veterans for Peace, for all of you, for having me at this important convention on this incredibly critical panel on the question of repression, political repression. And I extend a profound salute to all of you, to all of the members of Veterans for Peace. Thank you again to Josh, who I consider a comrade and a friend I've had the honor to work with. Thank you also to Ellen for your work in facilitating the technical aspects of this. And shout out to Bob Suberi and all of the members of Veterans for Peace in St. Louis, who we've had the honor to work closely with on several actions over the last few years. I want to start off by saying, free Palestine from the river to the sea, victory to the Palestinian people, free Leonard Peltier, not one more year, victory to the indigenous people of this land, free Mumia Abu-Jamal and all African political prisoners and prisoners of war. And I finally want to recognize Aaron Bushnell in light of the fact that in St. Louis, the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, the organization I represent, and Veterans for Peace held a joint vigil in honor of his heroic stance and martyrdom. So I say, long live Aaron Bushnell, and as he said, no more genocide in our name. As Josh stated, I represent the Hands-Off Uhuru Fight Back Coalition and the Uhuru Solidarity Movement. Uhuru means freedom in Swahili. I work under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party and its leader and founder, Chairman Omalia Shetela. Since 1972, when the African People's Socialist Party was founded, they have fought to unite African people around the world, including the Black community inside the United States, into a movement for the liberation and unification of Africa and African people everywhere, in a struggle against colonialism, against the colonial mode of production that dominates the planet Earth and has for the last 500 or 600 years. The Uhuru Solidarity Movement is the mass organization of the African People's Solidarity Committee, formed by the African People's Socialist Party in 1976 to extend the struggle for African liberation into the white colonizer population. I work under the direct leadership of Penny Hess, the chair of the African People's Solidarity Committee, who has worked to build solidarity with the African Revolution for 47 years. We believe reparations are owed to African people, and our mission is to build a mass movement in the white community for reparations and solidarity with Black power. Along with Penny Hess and Chairman Omalia Shetela, who is the primary target of the attack on the Uhuru movement, I am also one of the Uhuru Three. In just a couple of weeks, we will go to trial in the federal court in Tampa, Florida, facing bogus charges of being foreign agents and facing the possibility of up to 15 years in federal prison. I will talk to you now about this bogus case against the Uhuru Three and why it is so important to all of us who believe in free speech and political expression to join the fight back. On July 29th, 2022, the US government, in the form of its secret political police, the FBI, carried out pre-dawn, multi-state, coordinated, military-style SWAT raids on 7 homes and offices of the Uhuru movement in St. Louis, Missouri, and St. Petersburg, Florida, including the home of Chairman Omalia Shetela and the deputy chair, Ona Zaneya Shetela, including the home of Penny Hess, including the home of Akile Anai, another leader of the African People's Socialist Party, and the home of myself. The FBI came with flashbang grenades, drones, armored vehicles, assault rifles, aimed the laser sights of their rifles at the chest of Chairman Omalia Shetela, who is 82 years old, handcuffed him and others, and proceeded to raid the 7 homes and offices for at least 6 or 7 hours. Nobody was arrested that day, but we came to learn that a grand jury in Tampa, Florida, had indicted a Russian national who lives in Russia for allegedly, quote, recruiting people in the United States into a Russian conspiracy to sow discord in the US. I'm going to take a moment here to show you a video about what happened on July 29th, and then I will come back on and complete my remarks about this.
This is the FBI. You have a federal warrant for this address. Keep your hands up and follow orders. This is the FBI. We have a warrant for...
They handcuffed me and my wife out here. They wanted me to sit on the curb while they were carrying this out, something that I refused to do. They wanted my wife to sit on the curb out here that she refused to do.
As I was coming out, this big old drone met me.
The only revolutionary organization that's done something here on the ground practically for African people is the one that's come under attack. Institution that offers a community radio station, a newspaper, a commercial kitchen, an Aquabo Hall rental space, and community office for our organizers. That was the building that has come under attack.
We will build a movement of white people that says, hands off the Uhuru movement.
They see in the African People's Socialist Party a vanguard for the struggle for the liberation of our people. They see that because not just what we do here in the United States, but because we had the temerity to do like Garvey, to do like Malcolm X, and take the struggle of black people around the world.
So that video shows you a glimpse of what took place on July 29th. And as I mentioned, no one was actually arrested that day, despite the fact that many of us were handcuffed. But four of us were characterized, Chairman O'Malley, Yeshitela, Penny Hess, Akile, Anai, and myself, were characterized as unindicted co-conspirators in this absurd indictment that they manufactured against a Russian national for a so-called conspiracy to sow discord in the United States. 9 months went by with no further direct action taken by the federal government. But during that time period, a number of other forms of attack, clearly orchestrated by the U.S. government, took place, including the shutting down of bank accounts, the canceling of mortgages and lines of credit that had been operated by Uhuru movement organizations and institutions for decades, the dissolution of our fiscal sponsor, the revoking of a grant towards the Uhuru movement's Black community radio station, even the burning of a church across the street from where the chairman lives that had just come under contract for purchase by the Uhuru movement for use for Black community programs, and the list goes on. And finally, on April 18th of last year, 2023, a superseding indictment was unsealed, which now included criminal charges against Chairman O'Malley Yeshitela, Penny Hess, and myself, who are now referred to as the Uhuru Three. The charges against us are federal felonies that encompass a maximum prison sentence of 15 years for each of us. We are charged with one count of conspiracy to commit an offense against or defraud the United States government, which is known as 18 U.S.C. Section 371, and one count of a statute called 18 U.S.C. Section 951, which is similar and related to, but not exactly the same as the Foreign Agent Registration Act, which actually it has a steeper prison sentence than the Foreign Agent Registration Act, which charges us with working as secret, illegal foreign agents of the Russian government without notifying the Attorney General's office. And this law is referred to by the Department of Justice as espionage light, that is typically used to go after people that they are accusing of being spies, secret agents of a foreign government. The charges against the Uhuru movement are preposterous and obviously untrue. But more than that, they are based on an offensive and racist notion that Black people, that Chairman O'Malley Yeshitela or any Black person in the United States would require education or influence by Russians or anyone for them to come to the conclusion that they are being oppressed and that they have a right to fight to end their oppression. As the chairman has said, it was not Russia that got him involved in the Black freedom struggle. It was America. There were no Russians present at the murder of Mike Brown or George Floyd or Sandra Bland or Breonna Taylor. That was U.S. colonial oppression that did that. This charge attempts to erase from history not only Chairman O'Malley Yeshitela's more than 60 years of struggle for the liberation of African people, but also hundreds of years of struggle by African people for their freedom. From the inception of this colonial system that was built on the backs of their enslavement and on the genocide of the indigenous people of this land, our attorneys have said that these charges are so bogus that for us to take a plea would require us to commit perjury. Last July, one of our attorneys, Leonard Goodman, filed a motion for dismissal of the indictment based on the fact that the indictment itself is a violation of the First Amendment. We encourage people to read the indictment. Go to handsoffuhuru.org and read all of the legal documents. You will see everything they accuse the Uhuru movement of doing is in fact political speech protected by the First Amendment. They claim that we published articles, held events, held speaking tours, carried out a petition to charge the United States government with the crime of genocide against Black people in the United States, all of which are forms of pure political speech protected by the First Amendment. But they say, you did it for the Russians. This is the first time the US government has used this law to target pure political speech. Every other time, and I'm not saying that it was legitimate the other times they used it, but they created some charge beyond speech, whether it was spying, whether it was bribery, corruption. But in this case, it's pure speech. Just a few days ago, over a year after that motion for dismissal was filed, the judge in the federal court district in Tampa, Florida, denied the motion for dismissal. We are set to go to trial on September 3rd. The chairman and the Uhuru III are not guilty of these charges, but the United States and the FBI are guilty of countless murders of African freedom fighters, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Fred Hampton, 30 members of the Black Panther Party, and even around the world, Patrice Lumumba and so many others. In fact, the FBI cut its teeth working to destroy the movement in the 1920s of Marcus Garvey, who united millions of Black people around the world in the struggle for their freedom. The attack on the Uhuru III has widely been recognized as a test case for the limits of the US government's ability to criminalize political speech. This is why forces across the political spectrum have been moved to action by this attack. As the chairman has explained, the First Amendment was ratified in 1791 by one group of white settlers to free themselves from the tyranny of another group of colonizers while African people were still enslaved. Any democratic space that Black people have achieved in this country has been the consequence of life and death struggle. When McCarthyism arose in the 1950s and a measure of the terror and repression typically reserved for Black and other oppressed colonized peoples in this country began to make its appearance in the lives even of white people, it was the Black freedom struggle that pushed back the tide of this repression, that kept the society open. It was the courageous stand of Fannie Lou Hamer, of SNCC, of Paul Robeson, of African freedom fighters who stood then and who stand today as the torchbearers of democracy and democratic rights. That's why we say that it's more than a question of when they come for the Uhuru movement, they can come for you next. A more accurate statement is, when they come for the Uhuru movement, it's you they're coming for. The party, the African People's Socialist Party, is standing in the way, in the front of the barricades, fighting to protect all of the people's democratic rights from this blatant attempt to dismantle free speech as we know it. And if the US government succeeds in railroading the chairman and the Uhuru III into a guilty verdict, it sets the stage for them to indict anyone at any time for any speech they don't like, just by accusing you of doing it on behalf of a foreign government, simply on the basis of the fact that your views may align with that of a so-called foreign government. So to close my remarks, I want to say that the US government's intolerance for any speech that challenges their colonial stranglehold on the world's peoples shows not their strength, but their weakness and desperation. Under the bold and courageous leadership of Chairman Omalia Shetella, and with the support of all of our friends and allies, including you in this meeting today, we know we will win. We know we are winning. A massive mobilization of the people fighting for free speech, fighting for the right to stand in international solidarity, fighting for the right of oppressed people to organize for their liberation, can and will push them back. We invite everyone on this call to join us in St. Petersburg, Florida, on August 31st for a massive rally to demand that the US government drop the bogus charges against the Uhuru III, and to join us on September 3rd in the federal court in Tampa, Florida, to pack the courts, to pack the streets, because the real jury is the masses of the people and the real verdict will be won in the streets. And finally, we stand with Code Pink. We stand with all who find themselves in the crosshairs of US government repression. The Hands Off Uhuru Coalition issued a statement during the time period that Comrade Jody spoke of, condemning the attacks on Code Pink by the US government and its mouthpiece, the New York Times. We continue to stand with you against these attacks by the so-called Justice Department and the state-controlled media. We say, hands off Code Pink. We stand with all of the students and faculty at Columbia who have taken a courageous stand in support of the resistance of the Palestinian people. We say hands off the student protesters, victory to Palestine. To Veterans for Peace, the fight for the Uhuru 3 is a fight to defend your right to stand against war, genocide, colonialism, and to join with the rest of humanity. Hands off Uhuru, hands off Africa. Thank you.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is a panel from the Veterans for Peace 2024 convention entitled Resisting Repression, Strategies of Solidarity in the New McCarthy Era. We just heard Jesse Neville, who became active in the movement for reparations to African people in 2010 when he met Chairman Omali Yeshitela of the African People's Socialist Party. Next is Ali Wong, a PhD student in communications at Columbia University in New York City and one of the recent student organizers during the Justice for Palestine protest movement. Ali has served as a consultant on Middle Eastern regional security issues to various think tanks, research institutes, and international NGOs.
I'm a little overwhelmed. That was so powerful. Jesse, thank you for sharing. Jody, thank you for sharing. And I'm just really honored to be able to be on this panel and to get to share the story, and also really honored to get to speak to a group of people who have given their lives for our country, for our freedoms, for our ability to critique our government. And so thank you. So I'm going to talk about the new McCarthyism in the context of the front lines of protest at Columbia. And so Josh kind of went into a little bit of my background, and I wanted to just kind of highlight it to circle back around to the conversation of the new McCarthyism in terms of how people have responded to me speaking publicly about this. So just to recap, I'm currently a PhD student focused on religious extremism in the US and Russia, looking at the things that Josh mentions, disinformation, conspiracy theories, and radicalization. I'm also currently a consultant on the Middle East, North African regional security at the UN, and have a background in studying from an academic and experiential perspective, things such as human rights, peace, nonviolence, international affairs, and global conflict. I also have a master's degree in counterterrorism and nuclear policy. So I didn't really get involved with the student movement in an official capacity until after the first round of arrests, which took place on April 18th. Up until this point, there had been obviously protests on campus that had kind of cropped up on campus, around campus, but didn't get a ton of traction in terms of media coverage. On the morning of April 17th, there was a post that went out that compared 1968 with what was then erected that morning, an encampment on the front lawn of Columbia University. And this was organized by a group called the Columbia University Apartheid Divestment, or QUAD. And QUAD is a coalition of over 100 different student groups that are all rallied around the same shared vision for seeing Columbia divest from Israel and other corrupt governments to use our tuition dollars correctly in a way that is not going after the people and the community groups that we care about. So this encampment came up, and there were basically three main demands from QUAD. Divestment. So Columbia University's $13.8 billion endowment, of which only 0.5% is actually shared, how that money is spent, how it's invested. And so knowing that Columbia University is invested in a tremendous amount of companies that are involved in the war, things such as weaponry, equipment, and so forth. And so asking for divestment from Israel. Secondly, financial transparency. Like I said, there's so much money at Columbia, but there's little transparency as to how this is spent, where it's going, where our tuition dollars are. Amnesty for the students who have been targeted, those who have been arrested. Even prior to April, there had been chemical weapons used against pro-Palestinian protesters. Certain leaders of QUAD had been targeted, surveilled. And so wanting for both legal amnesty as well as amnesty in Columbia itself for those who have been evicted from their dorms, those who are facing suspension and expulsion. So I got involved with the protests on campus when I watched on April 18th, the police come onto campus and arrest, I believe, 108 students. At this point, the encampment had only been erected for about 24 hours. And myself and a few friends watched it all unfold from the journalism school, which is where I attend, which had an aerial shot of the encampment. And it was horrifying, but it was also really beautiful to see this encampment where people are, you know, breaking bread with each other, singing songs, sharing stories about their families and their cultures. To see the police militarized against peaceful protesters was horrifying. But as they were being led away, we saw basically everyone who was in the encampment just walk over and set up shop, you know, in the next lawn over. And so just kind of sharing this message that despite the police, despite the university administration, we would not be deterred from speaking out against a genocide that our tuition dollars are contributing to. So at that point, I started to get involved with a student union that eventually kind of linked me up with some of the organizers of Quad. And at this point, you know, some friends of mine and I started doing fundraising and contributing to the cause in sort of an unofficial capacity. I joined the student union that was offering a barrier of protection to the encampment by marching around the encampment, by using our voices and our physical bodies to be a barrier and to, you know, add numbers to this population to say, you know, what the university is doing and their lack of cooperation, their lack of negotiation over months is not okay. So through the course of getting involved with Quad and with the student union, I learned about an organizational structure according to risk. So red, green, and yellow. So yellow being those who want to take the least amount of risk. They'll picket, they'll, you know, advocate, but they're not going to risk arrest or any of their standing with the university. Yellow, a little bit more, and then red finally being those who are ride or die, you know, arrest us, beat us, do whatever you need to, because that's what protest is about. It's about being demonstrative of what you're willing to give up for the sake of peace, for the sake of the community that you're advocating for. And so I joined that latter group of those who are willing to take a higher risk. And I did that for several reasons. One, just being an American citizen puts me at a level of privilege that many of my friends and colleagues who are not American citizens just don't have. You know, I was not risking deportation. I was not risking a visa issue. The color of my skin. I have lighter skin than many of my friends and colleagues. And fortunately and unfortunately, that comes with different stereotypes that I won't be targeted for. I'm a PhD student, meaning that the university is invested in me in a way that it's not invested in other students. So knowing that I would have privileged standing. And then finally, my name is Ali Wong. There's a famous comedian that also shares my name. And so knowing that I would be a difficult person for trolls to find online. I don't have social media and I share my name with someone famous. And so fortunately, unfortunately, it's very difficult to find me online. So I knew that the risks that I were taking were still risks, but nothing compared to those of my friends and colleagues who were much higher risk of danger and long-term danger. So the day that the arrest took place on April 30th, it was basically kind of like I got a text message from this group of higher risk folks. And they said, it's go time. We have intel that says, you know, a police raid is imminent and we need people to guard this building that had been occupied the night before, because really thinking about property and space as being our only negotiating chip in our arsenal was really valuable. So I joined a group of students who were willing to kind of form a human barrier in front of this building that had been occupied. So when I got there, you know, at that point, the campus grounds had been pretty much cleared and people barred from being on campus. And so it was a really strange feeling because, you know, when you're on campus, there are just hundreds, if not thousands of people just buzzing everywhere. And so to be on campus in just this quiet serenity was a very odd feeling. And so when I got to the front of the building, we kind of formed this human chain. And all we did was we just sang. We sang really lovely songs about peace, about unity, about your people are my people, our struggles are aligned. And that was the site that the police walked into, was just us, a group of largely women, small women, arms linked, singing songs about peace. And once the police got onto campus, the people that are standing in front of us are three groups of people. It's a group of journalists, so press who had been given passes to be on campus, as well as student journalists. You had legal observers, so people, objective people who are there for the purposes of documenting what happens in case there is legal action that is taken after the fact. And then finally, the medical community, which these are standard things when you have protests that likely are going to result in violence, like the medical community, in case there is violence, to attend to whomever needs it. And so when the police came on campus, and I've seen estimates that are upwards of 1,000 police, they immediately kicked off those three groups of people. And at no point was I nervous, but when the police came and they kicked off that group of people, that's when I started to get nervous, because I knew that those three groups of people were there for our protection and were there for the documentation of what was likely about to occur, which would be violence. So as I mentioned, there were upwards of 1,000 armed military trained police officers of three different kinds of police to confront. There were about 24 of us in front of the building and 46 inside. So just the disparity of that is outrageous. It's overwhelming. It's almost cinematic. And so basically what happened is the police kicked off that group of people and then just descended on us, just started tearing us apart, started physically throwing us to the ground. At one point, I was struck in the head by likely a baton or shield or the butt of a gun, resulting in a welt on my head the size of a golf ball. I was injured in the ribs, and then I thought that I had broken my hand. Okay, so this is a scene. This is from Time magazine, actually. This is a scene of us being attacked. You can see me there on the left, kind of dodging a punch from an NYPD officer, and then the results of that the following day and next couple of days. Thought my hand was broken. You can see we were instructed to write down a legal firm on our arm for when we were arrested to be able to have that be our one phone call. We were denied a phone call. We were never read our rights. We were never given a conversation or told, you know, stand down or you'll be arrested. That was obviously implied in why we were there. But in terms of procedure, none of the things that are typically done when you are confronted with arrest were done. And we were massively brutalized. And it's worth mentioning that I had it easy. As it turns out, my hand was not broken, thankfully and unthankfully, because, you know, it's harder to say, oh, the police hurt me rather than broke my hand. But folks I was arrested with had skull fractures, broken ankles, broken wrists, a dislocated pelvis. Four people were taken into the hospital while they were in police custody. Students were evicted from their homes. So I decided to write about it and to be very vocal about it, again, because I felt so privileged to be in the position that I was, given everything that I just mentioned. I felt like it was my duty to speak publicly about this. And it was also one of the reasons why I chose arrest, because I knew that if I were arrested, it would give me the authority to speak to the media and help write the narrative. Up until this point, I had been seeing so many things in the news about that were just not representative of my experience as a Columbia student, talking about violent anti-Semitism when I had been to the encampment and it was just like a music festival. It was just, you know, people from all faiths and none, from all walks of life, just breaking bread together and sharing their stories in communities. And so seeing something so grossly different represented on the media was horrifying to me. So as a result, I made a lot of media appearances. I wrote an article in USA Today, which I think will be dropped in the chat, which was kind of more of a walkthrough of my experience. Appeared in NBC, NPR, New York Times, Time Magazine, a documentary, so on and so forth, because I felt like it was so important for me to share my experience when there are all these counter narratives coming up, talking about outside agitators, talking about how we've been radicalized, talking about how we were agents of Hamas or supporting terrorism. And so as a result, that put an obvious target on my back. And it resulted in more or less this, which was not a surprise. But basically, I was smeared all over online, all over Twitter, all over in the comment sections. I received death threats in my LinkedIn. People found my email by searching Columbia and wrote nasty things. And fortunately and unfortunately, I've done a lot of research on extremism online and terrorism. So I spent a lot of time in the dark corners of the internet and have read a lot of gross things. So this was not surprising, because this is what the internet is. And two, it's not like these are things that really particularly hurt me, but more just because the reason I mentioned kind of my academic background ahead of this is just because a lot of the rhetoric around this is, you know, you are a snowflake. You don't know what you're talking about. You are just privileged and, you know, you're woke and all these different things, libtard, whatever. And just really trying to discredit the things that myself and other people who are Columbia students, and so know how to think for ourselves, to try to invalidate the things that we've experienced, the things that make us qualified to speak on this issue in a nuanced way. So I bring this part up just because I really love that the theme is the new McCarthyism. In my master's, I did my master's thesis actually looking at the information operations between the US and Russia during the Cold War. And so I'm a student of Cold War history. And I would say arguably the most insidious thing that came out of McCarthyism, which ran from 1947 to 1959, was that although it was a government initiative that was strictly focused on government employees to root out communism, it permeated American society in a way that made people suspicious of their neighbors, of their friends, of their teachers, of officials. It created a culture of paranoia, initially aimed at an external adversary, but eventually one that turned insular and fostered a paranoid society that discouraged community and encouraged isolation on the basis of quote unquote safety. And so that's what we're seeing here, is this sense of paranoia, this sense of looking over your shoulder and finger pointing, trying to expose people for some kind of villain that you might think they are, and really to turn people against each other. And that's what I and other students in Columbia have witnessed. A dear friend of mine said, "It's not the protesters on campus that are making me feel unsafe. It's actually the university administration. It's all of the police that are being put on campus and turning this campus into a police state that makes me feel unsafe." So that's McCarthyism. It's wanting to try to root these things out, having this invisible enemy and making people turn against each other. And that's what we've seen on campus. And one of the beautiful things that came out, particularly of the USA Today article that I wrote, is that it was so widely shared that I was approached by several Jewish students who knew me personally afterward and said, "Thank you for writing that, because this has actually shaped my understanding of the protests." You know, so advice being, you know, lean in. Like, it's hard to hate people up close. And that's what the internet does, is it distances people, and it's hard to hate people up close. And so when you have a face, when you have a name, when you have a teacher or a TA or a student or a colleague who subscribes to something that's different from you, have those conversations, because that's where hate gets destroyed. That's where disunity becomes unity. So anyway, jumping back into our narrative, after I was arrested, there were several narratives that came out. The morning after, Eric Adams, who's the mayor of New York City, said the NYPD's precision policing ensured that the operation was organized, calm, and that there were no injuries or violent clashes. Manu Shafiq, who was our president up until several days ago, wrote an email to the camp, the university-wide email that I got several hours after returning home from being arrested and held in jail. And she said, "I thank the NYPD for their incredible professionalism and support." There were politicians in the days leading up to this and the days after who condemned what was happening on campus. Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House, came and had the audacity to stand on the top of our library steps and speak to something he knew nothing about, condemning the protest movement, condemning those who had erected the encampment, and saying that we were vilifying Jewish students on campus. Crucially, Jewish students have been so crucial to this movement. During the encampment, there was a Shabbat, Passover happened, and people, you know, shared a meal together. So anti-Semitism is not something that I personally have observed during the past few months. And then finally, media reporting, as I mentioned, just seeing the narrative that had come out before, during, and after all of these things happened was just so infuriating, because it just didn't represent my experience. So you have this system of people who you're paying through your tax dollars, paying through your tuition dollars to keep you safe, being the ones that are actually systemically gaslighting you. And that has been probably the central term that I've used to describe my experience with this, is that it's wild to have experienced something so physically, emotionally, and intellectually traumatic, and then to have everyone from the president of the United States to the president of your university to media outlets saying something that is completely contradictory to your own personal experience. And that for me has been the most traumatic aspect of it, is the fact that this story that I was beaten and arrested to be able to tell is one that is not being believed because of systemic gaslighting. So speaking, going back to the theme of new McCarthyism, one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot over the past few months is the cost of protest. As Josh mentioned, we're kind of building on the foundations of a long history of protest movements, student protest movements at Columbia, starting from 1968, the student movement that protested the Vietnam War, up through apartheid South Africa, and even now today, 2024, protesting the way that university uses our tuition dollars. And it's not to discredit any of the protests that have happened before, but I would argue that the cost of protest in 2024 is wildly more costly than it was in any other point in human history because of the internet, because you have things like doxing. Several days after being arrested, the NYPD released the names, addresses, ages, and genders, misgendering many people, of, I want to say, maybe 50 or 60 folks who were arrested. And this information then got proliferated all over the right-wing media and really gross websites online, and then catalyzed things like physical danger, stalking, harassing, vandalism, surveilling. There was one person I was arrested with who had their home with multiple children in it graffitied with pro-Nazi signs, misquoting and skewing involvement. So my experience with the media, I got kind of a crash course in the media and how the media kind of slices up your experience, slices up your story and uses it to their agenda and not letting a story be a story itself. Future employment. So the fact that the internet is forever, and for people who have been public, it does have a long-lasting impression on employers when they Google you. Legal consequences. There are folks who are inside the occupied building who are facing federal terrorism charges. Expulsion and suspension. Although things have quieted down over the summer, there have still been a lot of protesting as internal trials for student expulsion and suspension are happening. So yeah, all of these things mirror kind of the paranoia of the McCarthy era of, again, trying to turn people against each other, turn friends and neighbors into enemies. And that's what we're seeing now. So what comes next? I don't know. I know, but I don't know. This is something that we're building on a legacy of people who have been pushing for Israeli divestment for decades. This is probably the most significant stride that we've made so far. You know, we being myself and people who have come before me, probably the most significant stride that we've made so far. And we are not stopping until we achieve divestments. As I mentioned, Manu Shafiq, our former president, announced her resignation just several days ago. And so have been getting a lot of inquiries about people saying, oh, you know, that's huge. So what comes next? It is huge, but it actually doesn't affect our messaging whatsoever. We're asking for divestment, transparency, and amnesty. Okay, so she resigned. Tell me what you're going to do about divestment. Tell me how you're going to spend our tuition dollars, because that's what we care about. We don't really care about getting rid of university bureaucrats. I mean, we do, but what we're really asking for is the end to a genocide, the end to complicity in bombing our friends and neighbors. There are many people whose arms I linked up with, who I've been in contact with, whose tuition dollars have literally gone to bomb their own families, who have lost cousins and fathers and brothers and sisters and aunties. Like, their money, their tuition dollars are going to that. And so that is what we're asking. And so we are planning on continuing the protest movement. I'm not entirely sure what that will look like. And Quad is in the process of kind of recalibrating and refiguring out what it looks like to breathe life into this movement again come fall, because I think that in many respects, the university has hoped that we would just kind of go away after the summer and after the last police raid. But that is not happening anytime soon. We are determined, we are steadfast, and this isn't a momentary fleeting passion. This is something that many of us feel in our bones, feel in our blood, and are willing to do whatever it takes. So thank you so much.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. This episode was a panel from the Veterans for Peace 2024 convention entitled Resisting Repression, Strategies of Solidarity in the New McCarthy Era. The convention was held online August 16th through the 18th, 2024. The panelists were Jody Evans of Code Pink, Jesse Neville of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, and lastly, Ali Wong, a PhD student in communications at Columbia University in New York City. Thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.